This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Technology is advancing at a fast pace, and the forerunners or the front runners of these advancements are robotics, genomics, big data, just to name a few. As these changes occur throughout the world, many are left to wonder how to prepare for the job market these technologies will create and how to teach students about jobs and skills necessary for the future. Here on All Sides to discuss this and more is Alec Ross. He served as senior advisor for innovation to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and he is author of the new book, The Industries of the Future. Alec Ross, welcome to All Sides on 89.7.
Thanks for having me.
Alec, you compare this technology advance that's fueling these new industries to globalization and the change we've seen over the past couple of decades. How are they similar?
They're similar in that globalization and the technology change over the last 20, 25 years fundamentally changed our lives at work and at home. You know, when I was leaving college, you know, Northwestern University 22 years ago, I hadn't sent or received a single email. I didn't own a mobile phone until I was 30 years old. And yet now the internet, mobile, and so many other things have transformed the way we communicate, the way we engage in commerce. It's remarkable. But as remarkable as it is, the next 10 to 20 years, we'll see the pace of change just quicken. And so what I've tried to do in this book, The Industries of the Future, is in the face of this change that's going to be driven, as you described it, by fields like artificial intelligence, genomics, and big data, I'm trying to light a little path here so that people who normally wouldn't necessarily read books about these kinds of fields can read about what is accessible and enjoyable and help them understand, all right, we've wrapped our heads around the last 20 years of change. How can we prepare for the next 10 or 20?
Moving farther back from the past 20 years, have we ever seen a similar period where change was happening so rapidly? I think of the dawn of the Industrial Revolution and the move from rural economy to the city economy and factories and things like that. Is it in any way similar to that?
This is much faster. So the process of industrialization really took between 50 and 80 years. And in the places where it happened most quickly, in England and in parts of the Northeast and the Rust Belt, it was a disorienting transition from an agricultural economy into an industrial economy. I think that this is moving faster yet. And the difference is that when industrialization came to Ohio or to Michigan or the region like that, it was really changing life in the region, and it was connected more broadly in the U.S., but it wasn't global. Industrialization didn't really fuel global trade in Middle America until after 50, 75 years. The difference here is that if you are in Columbus, if you are in Cleveland, the change that this is fueling connects you to markets and transforms your relationship with markets on the other side of the world. So in the same way that land was the raw material of the agricultural age and iron was the raw material of the industrial age, data is the raw material of the information age, and data flows are happening awfully quick.
We're speaking with Alec Ross. He is a former advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, innovation advisor, also the author of the book called The Industries of the Future. We're talking about just that, Industries of the Future, here on 89.7 NPR News. If you'd like to join the conversation, have a question or a comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Alec, you mentioned that the data and the speed of communication around the world. But obviously, transportation, ease of transportation plays a role as well, because you could, I mean, being able to ship goods from Asia to North America easily, it plays a role as well, correct?
Oh, no, there's no question. And this is a case where the United States has got to do a lot better job. Our transportation infrastructure is non-competitive with what is in place in Asia and even in parts of Europe. My assistant did me the terrible disservice of actually totaling up my travel over the last 5 or 6 years. And I've traveled over 1 million miles to more than 50 countries, the equivalent of 2 round trips to the moon with a side trip to New Zealand. And, you know, nobody has more pride in America and in being American than me, but I can't help but be dismayed when I do travel to some of these advanced economies in East Asia and in Northern Europe, where their transportation systems make ours look medieval. And so where the United States did a good job with the highway system, we haven't done as very good a job with 21st century infrastructure.
What in particular, where are we falling behind in your mind?
We're falling behind in our ports, and we're falling apart in high-speed public transit. And we're also falling behind in, to name another infrastructure port, high-speed internet connectivity. You know, ports were the infrastructure of the 18th century. Railroads were the infrastructure of the 19th century. Highways were the infrastructure of the 20th century. 21st century infrastructure is high-speed public rail and broadband infrastructure. And we aren't the best in the world at it, unfortunately, and it's holding back our competitiveness.
So when you served as senior advisor for innovation for the Secretary of State, what did you see? What was your job? What were you looking for as you traveled the world?
So most of what I focused on were really nasty national security projects. So I wasn't the guy to do the server in the basement for Madam Secretary, for example.
I was going to ask, but I held off.
No, you got to ask. Look, I was not sort of the internal IT guy. My job was really to focus on how do we maximize the potential of technology to advance our foreign policy goals. I'll give you 2 quick examples. One was, as big as a mess as things are in Syria, my team was able to help stop the surgical political assassinations that were taking place there, where the Syrian intelligence service was finding where people were based on the GPS on their mobile phones and then being able to put in a mortar strike to precisely where they were based on the pulse on their mobile phone. So it was my team's job to degrade that capability. The other thing that, you know, that's been very much in the news lately is focused on the narcotics-fueled cartel violence in northern Mexico. You may remember 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago, the violence was completely out of control. It was in the news every day. Today, somewhat less so, and somewhat less so because my team at the State Department led a project that basically enabled every abuela and every barrio in these poor northern Mexican cities with a cell phone to use that cheap little cell phone and send anonymized, encrypted text messages that can essentially name where cartel members are. Oh, you know, I see a member of the La Familia cartel. He's drinking beer at this cafe. And by giving everybody who has a cell phone the ability to identify and help take down cartel members, we have significantly, you know, degraded the composition of the cartel leaders in northern Mexico.
So how did these experiences help you to understand what potential industries we're going to have to adapt to over the next 10 to 20 years, as you say?
Yeah, so it's really a product of, you know, being literally in almost every country on planet Earth. So while I would be doing national security projects in places like Mexico or Syria, these trips would also give me the opportunity to see what was being built in these and other societies. So when I was in Japan and South Korea, for example, I got to see how the robots of the cartoons and movies from the 1970s were well on their way to becoming the reality of the 2020s. I was able to travel to sub-Saharan Africa, which is a place that we think of as a center of conflict and development assistance, and see how, because of connectivity, once very poor, very isolated communities are now part of the global community. So while I was working on national security projects, the travel that I was able to do gave me a close-up view of what's happening on the 196-country chessboard.
So when you think of, you know, the industries of the future, you know, we as Americans, you know, we just assume that we are leading the way, that we are the ones who are carving the paths of the future industrialists, but you argue otherwise.
Well, no, I think that the United States remains the strongest place on planet Earth for innovation, for commercialization. But whereas so much of what's happened over the last 20 years has flowed through a 30-mile-long, 15-mile-wide area in California called Silicon Valley, I believe that there's going to be more geographic spread in the next wave of globalization and innovation. So where Silicon Valley really dominated the story of 1995 to 2015, Silicon Valley will remain strong, but I believe that there will be 10 to 15 places on planet Earth, three or four of which will be in the United States, which are sort of the global foci for innovation, places where we are imagining and inventing the future at a significant scale and the trillion-dollar industries that come with it.
What other parts of the world are rivaling Silicon Valley?
Well, I don't know that any place is rivaling it yet, but I do think that there will be places that are extremely strong. Interestingly enough, the number two place on planet Earth in terms of creating billion-dollar startups on a per capita basis is Stockholm, Sweden. So when I travel to Sweden and Norway and Finland and Denmark, these areas in far northern Europe, they have really prepared themselves for the industries of the future. And in large part because of what they've done with what we would call K-12 education. Their education systems in northern Europe are perfectly oriented towards the industries of the future, and it's beginning to pay off. Two other places that I would point to, one is Israel. Here, poor little Israel, surrounded by conflict, surrounded by economic ineptness, surrounded by hate. But the scientists and technologists in Israel do brilliant work. And as small as it is, it creates a lot of fabulous businesses, including, for example, in cybersecurity. And then the last two places I would point to are South Korea and Japan. You know, we think of Japan as a country associated with yesterday's economy. But in the same way in which it reinvented electronics and in the same way in which it reinvented car manufacturing, it and South Korea are extremely well positioned to be the headquarters of many of the artificial intelligence and robotics companies of the future.
We're speaking with Alec Ross, author of the book, The Industries of the Future, here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. When we come back, we'll get into some of these possible industries, robotics, genomics, cybersecurity. That's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the industries of the future. Our guest is Alec Ross. He is the author of a book titled The Industries of the Future. He also served as senior advisor for innovation to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Alec, robotics. You talk a lot about robotics in your book. And the main thing that we will see, according to your research and your observations, is robots will go from manual and repetitive tasks to cognitive and non-repetitive tasks. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is historically, when you think about robots and how it has displaced labor, it's tended to do the work of men with strong shoulders. So in ports, factories, and mills, it's able to pick up heavy things and move it, and do so where the actions are very repetitive. So take an action that has to be done 100 times over an hour, and it can do it more efficiently and effectively than a human being. There are two big developments that have taken place in the last 2 years in the fields of robotics, though, which is going to take it from doing this quote-unquote blue-collar work increasingly into being able to do what I would call low-level white-collar work. The first is a mathematical breakthrough called mapping belief space. What this does is it takes tasks that historically were very difficult for robots, like grasping, and have made it easier. So grasping may not seem very difficult, but it's actually very complex mathematically and algorithmically for robots to do. And the second thing is cloud robotics. So, Mike, if C-3PO walked into your studio right now and interrupted you, he would say, "Oh my, excuse me."
Yes.
And, you know, he would go clamber away, right?
Yeah.
In the movie version of that, when C-3PO did that, there would be an enormously powerful hardware and software combination whirring in that gold gleaming body. In reality, if C-3PO broke in, you know, wandered into your studio, he would be a cloud-connected device. He would ping the cloud, and what the cloud would give him the instructions to say, excuse yourself in English, and clamber on out of there. The significance of this is that instead of having to build robots with hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars worth of hardware and software, they can be relatively dumb, lightweight, low-cost devices, so long as they are internet-connected.
So what type of, you mentioned, what type of tasks would these robots be doing? You mentioned healthcare, working in nursing homes. I mean, will robots really have the ability to care for someone in a nursing home?
You know, I wouldn't think so, but it's happening. It's so strange. You know, I was in Japan, and Japan has the world's oldest citizens on a per capita basis. They're, you know, the mean age can get well into the 80s. And because of there are so many more older people than younger people, there aren't enough young people to take care of the grandchildren. And Toyota and Honda, yes, the car companies, have developed elder care robots. And what they can do is they can lift people and put them in bed, out of bed, help them get dressed, play the violin to entertain them. And so it's totally disorienting. And this is a case where the robots are coming out of a society where they don't have the sort of cultural baggage that we do in the United States. In the United States, you know, our mythology in the West, from Icarus's waxed wings to Frankenstein, has told us to fear that which we bring alive, mm-hmm. to make human that which is not human. What's interesting is in some of these Asian societies, they have beliefs like Shinto. So the Shinto religion is practiced by 80% of Japanese citizens. And they believe that all objects have a soul. And so they don't view robots as soulless. They view them as entities that can be incorporated in a family in a way that might really disorient an American. And to your question about what additional kinds of labor it can replace.
Oh, let's stick with the nursing home just for a second, and we can get into other labor. But, I mean, I can see a robot, a machine, lifting someone from a chair to a bed, but if everything goes as planned, if the person doesn't flinch, if the person doesn't struggle, doesn't do something unexpected. But that happens in real life. Can robots really be able to adapt to somebody who sort of twitches, and then the danger is that person would fall and break a hip or something like that?
So this is where robots are increasingly enabled by artificial intelligence. So a robot ought to actually anticipate that a patient could twitch or twist or do 14 other things. And if enabled with very powerful artificial intelligence, it will know what to do. Oh, this person is twisting at a 32-degree angle. I need to adjust myself at a 64-degree angle. Oh, this patient is screaming. You know, I need to hit a distress button so that the human monitor turns on the video camera in the room and can see what's happening. And so this is where stuff that really looks like it came out of a movie mm-hmm. comes into reality.
And how far away is this?
You know, it's already in place in Japan. It's already beginning. So it's like wealthy people in Seoul, South Korea, and Tokyo, Japan already have these. You know, the projections are that this will begin to move out of Asia within the next 4, 5, 6 years. When it comes to the United States, will be less a function of technological development, because the technology will develop and will be more a function of whether this is something we would want.
What do these robots look like? Do they look human? Are they just boxes with arms?
You know, right now it's interesting. They are less metallic than, say, C-3PO. But if you imagine C-3PO with sort of a white coating, that is how I could best describe them. But one thing that's kind of crazy is that there are advances in what's called material sciences, with things like electroactive polymers, air muscles, ferrofluids, which are enabling robots that to be developed that look more and more human. Now, this is not anything that's going to happen over the very short term, but if you think about movies like Ex Machina or The Terminator, the development for those kinds of materials is moving along and is probably 10 to 12 years away.
Interesting. We're talking about the industries of the future, robotics in particular, with Alec Ross. He's the author of the book titled The Industries of the Future. We welcome your comments and questions, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Moving away from healthcare, where else do you see these artificially intelligent robots moving into our daily lives?
I'll give you an example from my father's life. You know, I love my father, but for the last 40-some-odd years, he's worked as a country lawyer in Hurricane, West Virginia. And what he does, and what he's done for 40-some years, is he has created the tall stacks of paper that people have to sign 40, 50 times when they buy or sell a home. So there is cognition. There's some cognition, but there's really a lot of repetition. And so that kind of work, it won't be replaced by a robot per se, but it will be increasingly replaced by artificial intelligence. So the really fancy high-end lawyers who charge $600-$800 an hour and whose job it is to really counsel and educate clients and problem solve, they aren't going to lose their jobs. But for the kind of law that my father has practiced for 40-some years, where it's largely a repetitive task, that kind of thing can be automated, increasingly will be. A second example I'll point to is that I describe at some length in my book, The Industries of the Future, are surgical procedures. So anesthesia, for example. The most expensive part of a surgery is actually the anesthesia. And anesthesia robots have been created so that instead of an anesthesiologist having to be in the operating room, what now is becoming commonplace is that there will be one anesthesiologist monitoring five or six surgeries taking place simultaneously, but the actual anesthesia in those five or six places is being administered robotically.
And then if there was an emergency, the real-life anesthesiologist would be able to go to the room where he or she is needed?
That's right. And so this is a case of, again, there's, you know, a lawyer and an anesthesiologist are the essence of white-collar labor. And they aren't being replaced entirely, but the low-end or the mediocre ones are. And so the anesthesiologist, instead of there being five anesthesiologists in a hospital monitoring five surgeries, there would be one or two sitting in a room looking at a computer screen, monitoring everything that's happening. And if there's a problem, getting up out of the seat and walking over to see what's going on.
You mentioned, last week, Wendy's Hamburgers, which is located here in Central Ohio, announced that it is moving forward with smartphone and kiosk ordering at its restaurants. For how much longer will there be someone taking our order at a fast food restaurant, would you guess?
Oh, I wish longer than would otherwise be the case. But I think about it a little bit like the grocery store. So in grocery stores now, you may notice that where there were once always somebody there to check out your groceries, now increasingly you have to scan your own groceries. There will still be some lines where there's a human being, and bluntly, that's still the line I prefer to stand in. I would rather take an extra couple minutes and have a human being ring me up than have to ring myself up. And this is what it's going to be like in more and more fast food restaurants. where, you know, when you go to a McDonald's or a Burger King, instead of somebody taking your order and handing you your order, you'll go and you'll tap into something that looks like an iPad, and then it'll be delivered automatically. And the tragedy of this, of course, is that people who need those relatively low-wage jobs are going to be replaced or displaced. And so, you know, you mentioned this business in Central Ohio that's beginning to do this. This, unfortunately, is becoming more and more common.
And we see it in other countries. Is anyone actually using these kiosks now on a widespread basis, or is it still in the testing phase?
No, they are. I know a lot of our discussion, Mike, keeps going back to East Asia, but that's where it's really popular. You know, when I checked into a hotel in Tokyo, and it was a nice hotel, I was checked in by a robot, you know, and I could have gotten a human to help me, but just like with the anesthesiologist, there was a human there, but he was monitoring, you know, half a dozen different robots.
Yeah.
As opposed to there being half a dozen different people.
We've seen it in airports for years now, self-checking.
Oh, that's right. We have gotten to a kiosk mentality around a lot of different things, and the question is, what's next?
I tell you, I prefer it in a drive-thru at a fast food restaurant. You can hardly understand the person on the other side of the speaker. I don't think they can understand me either. I don't know. You know, Joe Pesci said in Lethal Weapon, you know, you always get the orders always get messed up in the drive-through, right? So,
no, you're right.
We're talking with Alec Ross. He is a former innovation advisor for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and also author of the book The Industries of the Future. We are talking about the industries of the future. You say that some jobs still will require the human touch. Which ones?
Well, I think about teaching, for example. Anything that involves social skills, persuasion, emotional intelligence, you know, there are lots of jobs that will still require the human touch. And I must say, the industries of the future is not, it's not a dystopian book. It is a mostly optimistic book. There will be enormous areas of job creation that go with some of the displacement. And so a lot of what my focus is on is, in the book, is, all right, well, what are those areas? If I'm a parent, you know, what education should I make sure that my kid is getting, either in school or outside of school? So I think about languages, for example, both computer languages and foreign languages. If the world is growing more global, then people who are able to communicate globally will be especially well-prepared and well-positioned to be business people of the future. And then computer languages. You know, if you are a decent computer programmer, you've basically got 30 years of guaranteed high paid employment in front of you.
We keep hearing that, you know, as the new economy takes hold, especially during a presidential election year, we need to change the way we educate kids and make sure they get the skills they need for tomorrow's economy. But in every scenario that you describe, there is a net loss of positions, it seems anyway. Is there enough education? Are there enough new skills to be learned to give everyone a good job, to replace the jobs eliminated by automation, robotics, and this new economy?
Not everyone. I mean, look, if you are a manual laborer, and you don't have a trade, if you aren't a plumber or an electrician or something that has some specialized skills, if your labor is rooted in the strength of your shoulders, then tomorrow is going to be more difficult than today. You know, I put myself through college back in West Virginia working as a midnight janitor and working on a beer truck. And the men that I worked with in those jobs 20 or 30 years earlier could have worked in a coal mine. They could have worked in a factory, made a lot more money, fed their families. Mom could have stayed home. Instead, they were on the midnight shift with me. So they were the losers in the last stage of globalization. Similarly, you know, even if you aren't a computer engineer, there are good jobs to be had. But if you don't have those skills, then I hate to say it, Mike, tomorrow is going to be tougher than today. And being a member of the middle class is actually going to be a challenge if you're getting out of high school and you don't have 21st century skills of any type.
But even if I mean, if all the low-level jobs are gone, and then you'd write about how even these sort of medium-level jobs like processing papers at a real estate closing, those jobs are gone. I mean, there's only so much tasks around.
That's right. And so the two things need to happen here. You know, first of all, we need to focus increasingly on vocational education. You know, we need to make sure our vocation – it's not sexy to talk about. The kids at the cool kids table – tend not to talk about vocational education, but those programs actually serve much of society's most vulnerable segments. So vocational education and community college needs to increasingly be oriented towards those areas where there is job growth. So I'm talking to you today from Baltimore, you know, home of the Freddie Gray riots and plenty of unemployment. In Baltimore, there are hundreds and hundreds of openings in cybersecurity, where if you have a certificate from a community college, let's, you know, not some fancy computer science degree from Ohio State. If you have a certificate from a community college, there's a $65,000 a year job waiting for you. So the question is, how do we match people growing up in these communities with, say, the certificate program in the community college to get one of those jobs where there are hundreds of vacancies? So, you know, look, it's not the strongest who survive or the most intelligent, but those most adaptable to change. Tomorrow is going to be tricky, but where people do have a willingness to focus on where there is job growth, there's plenty of opportunity. Like here in Baltimore, hundreds of openings in cybersecurity, just, you know, begging for people to have a little certificate.
We are talking about the industries of the future with Alec Ross, who is the author of a book by that same name, The Industries of the Future. We'll look at the future of cybersecurity, how this changing technology and changing industries can affect national security. We'll also look at blockchain technology when we return here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the industries of the future. It's kind of science fiction-like, but this stuff is happening now. It's happening in other places around the world, and it's something that we are going to have to deal with. And we're trying to look into that crystal ball and see where the industries of the future are, what we can do to prepare for them, how we can help educate the next generations to fill the needs of these industries. Our guest is Alec Ross. He was a senior innovation advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He's now teaching at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and also author of the book, The Industries of the Future. Alec, blockchain technology, what is that?
You know, this is the book is pretty accessible. This is one of the geekier little parts. Blockchain technology is an advancement in computer science. It was created for Bitcoin. Now, I think of Bitcoin like one of those search engines from the 1990s, you know, WebCrawler, AltaVista, Lycos, which, you know, look, faded from memory, but the category of search endured. Similarly, though, I think that the idea of a cryptocurrency, a currency that is all electronic, does have some virtue and value, though I don't think it will be Bitcoin. That which has emerged from Bitcoin that is proving to be special is blockchain technology. And what this is, it's basically a way to exchange assets, you know, to buy and sell stock, to transfer money, without a lot of friction, without the middlemen. So when I wire money right now, especially if I wire money outside of the United States, the fees are completely overwhelming. Anybody who works internationally knows the headache that comes from paying and being paid, moving money across borders. Blockchain technology can enable us to transfer money with, instead of fees of $10, $50, $100 to move money around the globe, it can be a penny. because of the reliability in this distributed ledger system.
So is this a new currency, or are we still dealing with dollars and euros and yen, or is this...
So the people who created Bitcoin use this technology to try to have Bitcoin be a currency like the dollar, the yen, the yuan, the euro, and what have you. That hasn't really worked. So what banks are doing now is they are using blockchain technology to be able to work in dollars. So Goldman Sachs, for example, and those guys know how to make money, just filed a patent for basically a way to exchange assets using blockchain technology, but doing so in dollars.
So this, the reason for this is it's cheaper to exchange for their, so their customers, it's cheaper for them to buy and sell things without the transfer fees and things like that.
That's exactly right. And where this becomes really interesting, let's go back to my father, the real estate lawyer in Hurricane West Virginia. If instead of paying thousands and thousands of dollars for a real estate closing, and it takes 6 months to set up, and you've got to sign 50 papers, that's a whole lot of friction. You know, the buyer wants to buy, the seller wants to sell, and all of a sudden it's costing lots of people a lot of time and money. Blockchain technology might be able to take away the middleman, in this case, the real estate lawyer, so that being able to transfer the asset reliably and legally no longer needs to involve a lawyer and thousands of dollars of closing costs and 6 weeks of waiting.
So this isn't a new currency. It's just a way to grease the skids a little bit.
That's exactly right. It's a way of being able to transfer an asset back and forth between people very reliably.
But do you have to be doing business within that system, though, like, say, within the Goldman Sachs system?
Yes.
And that would compete with, you know, another bank's system?
That's right. So the goal here is to create walled gardens, because what they want is that they want the transactions to take place on their platform.
Is this similar to the scrip issued by coal mine operators in the late 1800s that had to be spent at their stores in the coal towns?
The difference, so yes and no. Yes, in that it's a walled garden. It's a closed system. The difference is that it denominates in dollars. So scrip, you couldn't take your scrip and convert that easily into cash money.
You'd lose money if you did that, yeah.
Exactly. Whereas here, the idea is that it converts to cash, and it converts to cash, unlike scrip, where you might lose 40% of the value. It ought to convert to cash without losing any of the value.
But you have to stay within their system, though.
You do, but the idea is after you have done a transaction, after you've exchanged an asset in their system, you can then turn it into dollars and take it outside of their system.
Interesting. That is kind of geeky and mind-blowing. But
right? That's the geekiest part of the book.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of this guy I covered 20 years ago who wanted to do away with cash and put everything on a debit card because he thought his theory was it would eliminate burglaries and robberies, because no one had any cash, so they wouldn't have holdups. So,
well, and look what's happening with debit cards. You know, we've gone from having a cash-based economy to a plastic-based economy. Mm-hmm. You know, and so this is, even though we still carry cash, I don't know about you, but I've gone from doing probably 80-90% of my purchases in cash to probably doing fewer than 10%. I won't do much more than buy a cup of coffee or pick up my laundry and pay cash.
And now it's with smartphone technology, it's right there on your phone. You don't even need the card anymore.
That's right.
I guess that leads us to the whole security and big data. You see those big data first as a it's an industry now, but you see that growing.
I do. As I was saying earlier, in the same way in which land was the raw material of the agricultural age and iron the raw material of the industrial age, data is the raw material of the information age. He who owned the land or controlled the land during the agricultural age had the economic power. He who owned the factories and controlled access to the natural resources during the industrial era had the economic power. He or she who owned the data, controlled the data in today and tomorrow's economy are those with the real economic power.
Why is that? It just seems so, you hear the term big data and how powerful and how important it is. If I own an acre of land, I can feel it. I can build a house on it. I could build a business that succeeds on it, and I can sell that business. I don't understand how data, this sort of nebulous cloud of information, can be as powerful as a factory or as a parcel of land.
That's a great question. So let's take this back to land. Let's talk about farming, for example. The world's population right now is 7.2 billion. 7.2 billion souls on this planet of ours. It's about to go from 7.2 billion to 9 billion. And we need to produce 80% more food lest the world grow hungrier. The way that the agricultural companies have figured out how we're going to be able to produce that much more food at a same time where we obviously aren't getting any more land and where water is an increasingly scarce resource is through data. I'll give you an example of where I saw this. In New Zealand, of all places, New Zealand has 3 or 4 cows for every human being. So they have these ranches with thousands of heads of cattle on them. And the folks in New Zealand wanted to be able to export beef and dairy products to the growing middle class in China. They had practiced agriculture the same way for 200 or 300 years. So what they did to respond to that is they created something called Pasture Meter, which combined GPS technology and laser technologies to be able to take 18,500 measurements of a field. Okay, so great. Mm-hmm. You've got a field with a couple thousand head of cattle. You know about every square inch of it. So what? What does that mean? Well, what it means is that instead of just blanketing the field with a fixed amount of fertilizer and just, you know, watering it because it's Tuesday, what the farmer now knows is down to the most granular detail where to put feed in the paddock, where to put fertilizer, the exact mixture of nitrogen and phosphorus in the fertilizer mix. And by being able to be a very precise farmer, when you're working at a great scale, you're able to increase efficiency and output by a huge amount.
And that can give you an advantage over the farmer next door that doesn't have that.
And so what happened in New Zealand is they did this as an entire community because they wanted the whole country to be able to export beef and dairy to China. And in less than 2 years, there was a 500% increase in exports to China. And that was by taking, you know, rough old dairy farmers and turning them into people who suddenly could use big data analytics to get more out of those cows.
We're speaking with Alec Ross. He is the author of the book, The Industries of the Future. And that's just what we're talking about, is how industry worldwide is changing and how it will change in the coming years. Who would have thought that there was a thing called Uber just 5 years ago? There has to be industries we haven't even thought of that's going to pop up in the next 15, 20 years.
Look, I think they all are, bluntly. And here's my attitude. If you are in one of these industries, either you disrupt yourself, either you change your industry, or it'll be changed for you by a 28-year-old in California. So I know the guys who started Uber, and I know the guys who started Airbnb. They're intelligent, but they aren't these are not the smartest people on planet Earth. They're smart. But they certainly didn't know anything about lodging in the case of Airbnb, or transportation in the case of Uber. What the guys who started these companies did understand, though, was how to create a smart user interface, use tools like GPS, mapping, and create an online marketplace, and, oh, by the way, data. Mm-hmm. And even though they didn't know squat about taxis or transportations or the hotel industry, they were able to create businesses worth tens of billions of dollars. And so I think that just about all industries will be transformed by digitization, by software. And the question is, does that come from within the industry, or, as was the case with Uber and Airbnb, does it come from a couple of kids in California?
Yeah, that brings me to our final point, with just a couple of minutes left, is coping with the change. And you mentioned that, you know, you wish your parents had written a book similar to what you've written when it comes to globalization, and they would have been better prepared for it. You know, and globalization had been happening on a much smaller scale. You look at the textile mills that moved from New England down south and then to Mexico and then overseas. It's not only spotting that it's going to happen, but your willingness to adapt both economically, politically, to adjust to these new realities. How that's a huge challenge for folks who like the way things are right now.
Mike, you're absolutely right. And the end of the book is called The Most Important Job You'll Ever Have. And the most important job you'll ever have is being a parent. You know, I've got a 13-year-old son, an 11-year-old daughter, and a 9-year-old son. And I wrote this book to give parents and grandparents tools so that as their kids are growing up, they have some very specific ideas about what they can do to help their kids adapt. And similarly, for people just coming out of college and beginning their careers, if you're 22, 23, 29, 30 years old, for that matter, and you're trying to figure out what, you know, the path is for you over the next 10 or 15 years to be able to really make it economically, I wrote this book to try to light that path. Because to your point, Mike, it is all about adaptability. Tomorrow is going to be great economically for a lot of people, but it's also going to be tough for a lot of people. And rather than curling into the fetal position, I tried to write this book to try to light a little path for people.
So take your advantage of your home state of West Virginia. I think many people believe that the days of coal are numbered. How big that number is, we don't know. But with natural gas and continuing emphasis on clean air, how do you get that message? How do you convince a coal miner or a politician that represents a coal miner to embrace this possible change?
Well, you know, look, if they don't recognize they have had a bad last 20 years, then nobody can help them. You know, look, the day I was born in West Virginia, the state had 2.1 million people. Today it has 1.7 million. The town I was born in, day I was born, had 80,000 people. Today it has 55,000 people. You know, you drive down the street where my parents live and every other house has a for sale sign in front of it. So, look, if people there can't recognize that they failed in the last stage of globalization, and look, I'm not going to be cute about this. West Virginia failed in the last 20, 25 years economically. If you don't recognize that you have a problem, then nothing can be done for you. But I do believe in the communities like the one that I grew up in, and the men who I worked shoulder to shoulder with on the midnight janitor staff, I do think that people recognize that something needs to be done, but they just need tools. They just need a little bit of help, a little bit of guidance.
Is it also, you know, the stick also when a mine shuts down that forces people to act? There's going to be some of that in the future. You talk about the pain that is coming.
No, that's right. Look, it's fight or flight. You know, you can fight it or you can run away from it. And, you know, I think that, you know, again, I come back to parents. You know, working class, middle class parents are willing to fight for their kids. They are desperate for their kids to live lives that are at least as good as the one that they had and hopefully better. Certainly, they don't want their children to grow up and have economically worse lives than they did. And so, you know, I wouldn't put this on the shoulder of young people, though they do need to work. Part of where my focus really is on parents and grandparents, to give them the tools so that they can focus in on their kids.
To lay the groundwork. Thank you, Alec Ross, author of the book, The Industries of the Future. It's a exciting yet scary time, the rapid pace of change in our economy. Thank you for joining us here on All Sides, Alec.
Thanks for having me.
This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher, with me, Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.